Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Gazette here for August 18th, 2022, on the IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And I am your reader, Peter Welch. In Iowa City, drivers traveling south on Interstate 380 should be prepared for a significant change Friday morning as an old ramp closes and a new flyover ramp opens, a big milestone for the massive reconstruction of the Interstate 80 and 380 interchange. The existing loop that connected I-380 southbound to I-80 eastbound will close permanently as the new flyover ramp opens. The exit towards I-80 eastbound will now be about half a mile earlier on I-380. This is the last of the loop ramps to close within the interchange, and it is the second flyover ramp to open. The flyover ramp uses a new elevated bridge. The safety hazard with the loops is what was driving the whole project in the first place, and the last one will finally be gone, said Hugh Holock, resident construction engineer with the Iowa Department of Transportation. Holock said that the Iowa DOT anticipates some initial confusion with the exit toward I-80 eastbound, exit OA toward Iowa City, being about half a mile earlier. For drivers, that means the exit toward Iowa City will now be before the exit for I-80 westbound. The westbound exit, exit OB toward Des Moines, will remain in the same location. This is going to be one of our more confusing moves because by the time you realize you've missed the exit, you've missed it by 3/4 of a mile, Holick said. Once traffic gets used to this move, it shouldn't be a real issue at all anymore, he added. For those who miss the exit, the Iowa DOT suggests using exit OB to the west to detour to Ireland Avenue, which is exit 237 on I-80. Motorists also can detour south to Melrose Avenue, which is exit 93. And an online map shows the two detours that can be used to turn around. Signs will be changed overnight to help drivers navigate the changes. There also will be extra law enforcement to help with any confusion, Holick said. The first day is likely to overpopulate Melrose, Holick said. By Monday, it should be fine. Everybody will know where they are going. The work is part of a $387 million interchange project, which is at the junction of I-80, I-380, and Highway 218 in Johnson County. It's one of the Iowa Department of Transportation's top priorities. The project is in its fourth year of construction. The multi-year project will replace all four loops of the interchange with directional ramps. Additionally, parts of I-380 north of I-80 and parts of Highway 218 south of I-80 will be widened, as well as I-80 on both sides of the interchange. Work on the interchange project is expected to continue through 2024, with final erosion control expected in 2025. If you have any comments, contact 319-339-3155. Iowa City agrees to expand assistance program. Council also hears update on relocation program for Forest View residents. The 319 Johnson County residents who did not initially receive a $1,400 check from the county's direct assistance program despite being eligible are likely to receive one after all. The Iowa City Council at its meeting this week unanimously voted to front just over $456,000 in order to free up county dollars for the 319 residents initially left out. There was enough funding allocated for the program for everyone to receive a check, but the way the agreement was written affected the order in which funds were dispersed. Eligible applicants were chosen by random selection. residents have pushed for faster action as they've been waiting in limbo since mid-July when others received their direct assistance checks. Council members expressed urgency on Tuesday in getting the remaining residents funded after the county rejected an offer to equally split the cost. These are some of the most vulnerable members of our community, Councilmember Pauline Taylor said. Iowa City will pay $446,600 in direct assistance payments and $9,432.83 in check processing for a total of $456,032.83. This is in addition to the initial costs estimated between $700,000 and $750,000. And in other news, citing pandemic mistakes, CDC vows shakeup. Agency faulted as ponderous seeks to be more nimble. The head of the nation's top public health agency announced a shakeup of the organization Wednesday, saying it fell short responding to COVID-19 and needs to become more nimble. The planned changes at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that leaders call a reset come amid criticism of the agency's response to COVID-19, monkeypox, and other public health threats. The changes include internal staffing moves and steps to speed up data releases over publication of research. The CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, told the agency staff about the changes on Wednesday. It's a CDC initiative, she said, and was not directed by the White House. I feel like it's my responsibility to lead this agency to a better place after a really challenging 3 years, Walensky told the Associated Press. The Atlanta-based agency with $12 billion budget and more than 11,000 employees is charged with protecting Americans from disease outbreaks and other public health threats. It's customary for each CDC director to do some reorganizing, but Walensky's action comes amid a wider demand for change. The agency long has been criticized as too ponderous, focusing on collection and analysis of data, but not acting quickly against new health threats. Public unhappiness with the agency grew dramatically during the pandemic. Experts said that the CDC was slow to recognize how much virus was entering the United States from Europe, to recommend people wear masks, to say that the virus can spread through the air, and to ramp up testing for new variants. We saw during COVID that CDC's structures, frankly, weren't designed to take in information, digest it, and disseminate it to the public at the speed necessary, said Jason Schwartz, a health policy researcher at the Yale School of Public Health. Walensky, who became director in January of 2021, has long said that the agency has to move faster and communicate better, but stumbles have continued during her tenure. In April, she called for an in-depth review of the agency, which resulted in the announced changes. It's not lost on me that we fell short in many ways responding to the coronavirus, Walensky went on to say. We had some pretty public mistakes, and so much of this effort was to hold up the mirror to understand where and how we could do better. Her reorganization proposal must be approved by the Department of Health and Human Services Secretary. CDC officials say they hope to have a full page of changes finalized, approved, and underway by early next year. Some changes still are being formulated, but steps announced Wednesday include the following: increasing use of reports to get out actionable data instead of waiting for research to go through peer review and publication by the CDC Journal Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, restructuring the agency's communication office, and further revamping CDC websites to make the agency's guidance for the public is more clear and easier to find. altering the length of time agency leaders are devoted to outbreak responses to a minimum of 6 months, an effort to address a turnover presentation that at times caused knowledge gaps and affected the agency's communications. Creation of new executive council to help Walensky set strategy and priorities. Appointing Mary Wakefield as senior counselor to implement the changes. Wakefield headed the Health Resources and Services Administration during the Obama administration and also served as the number two administrator at HHS. Wakefield, age 68, started on Monday. Altering the agency's organization chart to undo some changes made during the Trump administration. Establishing an Office of Intergovernmental Affairs to smooth partnerships with other agencies, as well as a higher-level office on health equity. Walensky also said that she intends to get rid of some of the reporting layers that exist, and I'd like to work to break down some of the silos. She did not say exactly what that may entail, but emphasized that the changes are less about redrawing the organization chart than rethinking how the CDC does business and motivates staff. This will not be simply moving boxes on the organization chart, she said. Schwartz said that flaws in the federal response go beyond the CDC because the White House and other agencies were heavily involved. A CDC reorganization is a positive step, but I hope it's not the end of the story, Schwartz said. He would like to see a broader accounting of how the federal government handles health crises. And in other news, accused taboo shooter faces another murder charge. And in other news, Timothy Rush, accused of fatally shooting his girlfriend April 10th inside the downtown Taboo nightclub and lounge, is now facing an additional murder charge after a man who was injured in the shooting died on the 24th of July. In all, three people were killed and about 10 injured in the shooting that police said involved two gunmen, one who still awaits extradition to Iowa after being captured near Chicago. Rush is accused of fatally shooting Nicole Owens, age 35, the mother of his one-year-old daughter, and of shooting Marvin Cox, age 31, of Cedar Rapids in the head. Cox had been on life support until his death. Rush originally was charged with one count of second-degree murder and the death of his girlfriend, as well as three counts of willful injury causing serious injury, three counts of reckless use of a firearm causing serious injury, three counts of willful injury causing bodily injury, three counts of reckless use of a firearm causing bodily injury, one count of intimidation with a dangerous weapon, and one count of possession of a firearm as a felon. This week, a judge accepted a motion to amend the charges against Rush to remove one count of willful injury and one count of reckless use of a firearm and instead add an additional second-degree murder charge. A memorial service was held for Cox on the 6th of August, according to an obituary on the Cedar Memorial website. Cox was born in Chicago. He loved sports, especially basketball, and enjoyed playing video games. Marvin was an awesome father and was a role model to many, according to the obituary. While Cox was on life support in the hospital, his mother, Marie Mulkey of Cedar Rapids, told the Gazette that she'd been with him every day. "It's very hard for us. He's sitting in that hospital fighting for his life," Mulkey said. A trial for Rush is scheduled for March 28th in Linn County District Court. And let's now go over to Marion. The city of Marion is considering appointing a subcommittee to consider the future of the Marion Airport, a future that could result in the city taking full ownership of the airport. The small airport in East Marion now is a public-private partnership. This is the only public-private hybrid airport in the entire state, and it's just not working well. So this group needs to bring those two lenses together and figure out if the city should invest more money, and if so, what should it look like? Council member Steve Jensen said at a Tuesday night council work session, the city owns the airport runway and fixed-based operation building. Only the city-owned portion is eligible for funding and grants from the state and federal governments. Luxair Aviation manages the facility and owns the rest of the airport property. Luxair was formed in 2015 by Genesis Equities owner Jeff Witter and his daughter Hannah Acoustis. The city has a municipal airport committee that oversees the airport's operations, but council members thought a new subcommittee could recommend next steps. If we were to rewind back to 2014-2015, council member Grant Harper said, a group like this, had it existed, would have painted a more robust picture. This serves a need that has existed for a long time. The initial thinking was that the temporary subcommittee would consist of two city council members, two municipal airport committee members, a Marion Enterprise Center business representative or president of the Marion Economic Development Corps, and a representative from Collins Aerospace. It could have seven members, city manager Ryan Waller said. These are just ideas and concepts, but we don't want to box any entity in. The council likely will consider establishing the airport visioning subcommittee at a later meeting. Airport history. The airport is on the east side of Marion, near the police department and Marion Enterprise Center, in an area seeing rapid development. It's been in operation since the 1950s. Jan Walton and her husband, Perry, began operating it in 1986 and bought it in 1994. Perry Walton died in 2014. In May 2015, the city bought some of the airport property for $1.67 million, paying twice as much per acre than Luxair had paid for the property a few hours before. The airport provides services for small planes, private business travel, air ambulances, flight training, charters, aerial photography, and agricultural spraying. The number of aircraft using the airport has decreased since 2018, partly due to construction of a $1.8 million extension to the north-south runway and to Derichko damage to airport hangars, according to an HDR engineering report. One need that the city and airport users have identified is adding an east-west runway. In 2017, the cost of that runway was estimated at $9 million. Iowa City delays decision on ousting Truth Panel member. Amel Ali will remain on the City Truth and Reconciliation Commission as a restorative justice process begins to repair harm caused by comments she made on a local podcast. The Iowa City Council voted Tuesday night to indefinitely table the decision to remove Ali from the commission. The 6-1 vote, which is the second time the council has tabled this decision, came after 2.5 hours of emotional public comment and council discussion. Mayor Bruce Teague was the sole vote against tabling. Ali remains on the panel but is no longer chair. The commission voted early this month to suspend the title of chair from Ali. Calls for Ali's removal became public earlier this month after claims she used a racial insult against other black leaders and made disparaging comments on a local podcast. The two podcast episodes on which Ali was a guest are no longer online. The episodes were originally published behind a paywall. Ali has apologized for the comments. On Tuesday, Ali outlined to the council what a potential restorative justice process could look like and said that she would not take a leadership role within the commission when this is happening. Some city council members raised concerns over how the commission could move forward with its truth-telling mission on racial concerns if some members of the community don't feel welcome sharing their experiences. But others highlighted the potential for restorative justice to repair the harm caused by the remarks, and how this is a chance now for the commission to do the very work it's been tasked to do. The TRC has operated under more scrutiny than probably any other commission has ever functioned in our city, particularly scrutiny from us, Councilmember Laura Burgess said. We have heard loud and clear from the TRC members that they want to address this. She said if the council steps in now and we just say punishment is the only option, we will not allow that process to continue. And let's now go down to the Des Moines area here in Iowa. Attorney General challenger campaign at fair. In Des Moines, Brina Byrd, the Republican challenger, promised to be a fighter against the Democratic federal administration. Tom Miller, the Democratic incumbent, promised to continue addressing violent crimes, holding opioid manufacturers accountable, and protecting Iowa consumers from scams. Miller and Byrd, the candidates for Iowa Attorney General, the state's lawyer, spoke this past week at the Des Moines Register political soapbox at the Iowa State Fair. Miller, who spoke Wednesday afternoon, said his guiding star in office has been to do what's right by the law. Miller is the longest serving state attorney general in U.S. history. He's completing his 10th four-year term as attorney general and has served in the office since 1979, except for 4 years from 1991 to 1994, when he went into private practice. What the law is and what the basic legal principles are our guideposts, Miller said, not what particular people or large groups of people want us to do despite that. I think we have a reputation for doing that. Byrd, whose turn on the soapbox came on Saturday, said if elected, she would support law enforcement and legally challenge executive actions coming from President Joe Biden. Byrd claimed that law enforcement officials are underappreciated and have been villainized by Democrats. The current attorney general is silent, and when it comes to supporting law enforcement, she said, when I'm attorney general, we will back the blue and we will work with law enforcement. Byrd said that the Biden administration has been hampering Iowans and farmers through executive actions, and she said she would sue the administration over unconstitutional mandates. With 2 years left in Biden's term after the November elections, Byrd said that her election would be a check on the federal government. Miller said that shows the difference between him and Byrd as candidates. Byrd has a strong commitment to the ideology and the partisan politics of issues. That's exemplified by when she announced her campaign. It was almost all she was going to sue Biden, anti-Biden, Miller said, and that's essentially an ideological agenda. It's not an agenda that will affect Iowans. In her soapbox remarks, Byrd did not specify policies she would challenge, but she has previously taken aim at policies like Environmental Protection Agency regulations on water quality, like the Waters of the U.S. rule, and herbicides and implementation of protections for endangered species. It will become even more important, Byrd said, that Iowa has an attorney general who will stand up for freedom, who will stand up for farmers, who will enforce the federal constitution and laws on the federal government. Byrd said Miller is not prioritizing the interests of Iowans and has been in office too long. The general election is the 8th of November. Early voting in Iowa starts the 19th of October. In other Des Moines news, Christina Bonahan said that she likes what's in the new Inflation Reduction Act that is designed to address inflation, climate change, and health care costs. Bonahan, a Democratic running for Congress in Eastern Iowa's new 1st District, is challenging first-term incumbent Republican U.S. Representative Marinette Miller Meeks. I think there's a lot of good in there for Iowa. Frankly, I don't understand why Congressman Miller Meeks would vote against a bill like that, Christina went on to say Wednesday after appearing at the Des Moines Register political soapbox at the Iowa State Fair. It does everything Iowans need it to do, the Iowa City law professor went on to say. The legislation signed into law Tuesday by President Joe Biden attempts to address inflation by reducing the federal deficit and increasing taxes on high income businesses. It boosts clean energy tax breaks, and it allows Medicare to negotiate for prescription drugs while capping insulin costs at $35 per month for Medicare patients. According to U.S. Senate Democrats, the new law will raise $737 billion in federal revenue, with $369 billion going toward climate change policies, $300 billion to deficit reduction, $64 billion to health care, and $4 billion to drought programs. The federal legislation was approved on straight party line votes, with all Democrats approving and all Republicans opposing. Republicans have argued that the legislation represents more federal government taxing and spending and said it will not constrain inflation. Miller Meeks did not accept the invitation to speak at the soapbox and did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Bonahan's statement. At the time the Inflation Reduction Act was approved in the House, Miller Meeks said in a statement that our country is facing skyrocketing inflation and our economy has been thrown into a recession. Now is not the time to pass a $740 billion spending bill, let alone one filled with partisan priorities. This enormous spending package is bad for Iowans, bad for patients, bad for the economy and hardworking Americans, and bad for the future of American innovation. At the state fair, Christina Bonahan said that most Iowans agree on the problems facing them, but that politics get in the way of solutions. She said extreme politics are particularly slowing progress and cited the need for federal representatives to work together. She touted her endorsements from two people who have previously represented the Iowa District in Congress, Democrat Dave Lobsack and Republican Jim Leach. People want someone who is looking out for them, not for special interests, Bonahan told reporters after her remarks. The general election is the 8th of November. Early voting in Iowa starts on the 19th of October. Other Des Moines news here today. A Des Moines City Council member is countersuing two police officers who took the unusual step earlier this year of suing several people who participated in a 2020 protest following a Minneapolis officer's killing of George Floyd. Indira Shoemaker's countersuit says that of officers Peter Wilson and Jeffrey George used excessive force and violated her civil rights when they arrested her during a protest on the 1st of July 2020 outside the Iowa Capitol. Shoemaker's lawsuit, first reported by the Des Moines Register, also accuses the officers of filing a frivolous lawsuit against protesters. In June, Wilson and George sued Shoemaker and five other protesters, accusing them of assault and seeking monetary damages. The protest was among the demonstrations against racism and police brutality that erupted after Floyd's killing. It began as a rally at the Iowa Capitol to push for restored voting rights to felons and turned violent as police led away arrested protesters. The officers' suit, which they filed as individuals and not as representatives of the Des Moines Police Department, accuses Shoemaker and another protester of putting George in a chokehold as protesters attempted to thwart attempts to arrest several people. The officers' lawsuit describes protesters' actions as nothing short of domestic terrorism. Protesters have said that the police escalated tensions and were heavy-handed in making arrests. Shoemaker, who was elected to the city council in 2021, denies the officers' accusations in her countersuit. The lawsuit says that she was taking video of police actions when she was pushed by the crowd into George. As she tried to get back on her feet, her countersuit says Wilson put her in a chokehold and dragged her across the ground before officers tackled her. Shoemaker also states in her counterclaim that the officer's lawsuit is barred by Iowa case law known as the Fireman's Rule, which generally keeps emergency responders from suing or collecting damages for injuries that occur in the course of their duties. The office's attorney, Mark Hedberg, called Shoemaker's claim meritless, the Des Moines Register reports. Regarding COVID-19, 19 hospitalizations dropped 24% in Iowa in the past week. The number of new cases also decreased by double digits. As of Wednesday, 244 Iowans were hospitalized with COVID, down from the 323 hospitalizations reported the previous week. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the number of COVID-19 patients in intensive care also decreased in the past week from 32 to 27. In the past week, 4,921 new virus cases were reported, down 13% from the 5,660 cases reported last week, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Since the start of the pandemic, Iowa has reported 832,937 cases of COVID-19. The total is likely higher given the availability of at-home test kits, which are not reported to the state. Linn County reported 392 new cases in the past week, up from last week's 384 new cases. Since March 2020, the county has reported 58,742 cases. Johnson County reported 306 new cases in the past week, down from last week's 320 cases. To date, the county has reported 40,720 cases since the pandemic began. And we want to remind you that you are listening to the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, also known as IRIS. I am your narrator, Peter Welch, and we are reading from the Gazette here today. Here is some obituary news. Hedy Deutschtermann has passed away on the 15th of August. A visitation will be held from 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday on the 21st of August at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. A private graveside funeral will be held on Tuesday, the 23rd of August at the Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Susan A. Dunning, age 61, has passed on August 17th. 2022, after a long illness, surrounded by her loving family. A private family memorial gathering will be held at a later date. Online condolences and memories may be shared with the family at www.iowacremation.com. Karen M. Peschel, age 80, of Cedar Rapids, has passed on August 14th at the age of 80. And Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cedar Rapids will be handling all of the services. A funeral service will also take place at 2 p.m. on Saturday, the 27th of August, at the funeral home. Per the family's wishes, the casket will remain closed for visitation and service. Burials will follow the service at the Linwood Cemetery Mausoleum in Cedar Rapids. Other obituary news, Kenneth Joseph Greenier has passed at the age of 81, and he was living at the Keokuk County Health Center in Sigourney. A memorial fund has been established for the Kyoto QRS, Essence of Life Hospice, or Keokuk County Expo. Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Services at Kyoto is caring for Kenneth and his family. Tributes may be made at www.powellfuneralhomes.com. And finally, Christy Ann Booth Songer has passed on the 12th of August, 2022, in Mason City. No funeral services will be held. Memorials may be directed to Mercy Hospital Hall, Perrine Cancer Center, Patient Care in Cedar Rapids, Camp Courageous in Monticello, or any local animal welfare or humane society. Now let's go to the other part of our country, to LA, Los Angeles, California. At-home coronavirus screening has become a way of life for many, but some medical experts are cautioning that one test may not be enough to definitively determine whether someone is infected. Health officials stress that home tests are a vital and accurate way of tracking COVID-19 infections, but an initial negative test doesn't mean people are out of the woods. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration suggested last week that those checking to determine whether they are infected should use multiple tests over a period of days. When you perform an at-home COVID-19 antigen test and you get a positive result, the results are typically accurate, government officials wrote in a public statement. However, if you perform an at-home COVID-19 antigen test, you could get a false negative result. Because of this, the agency recommends repeat testing following a negative result, whether or not you have COVID-19 symptoms. The risk of misleading results seems to be higher among symptomatic people infected with the latest dominant Omicron subvariant, BA5, compared with earlier versions. This, experts say, further illustrates the importance of follow-up tests. If your first home antigen test is negative, we recommend repeating it 24 to 48 hours. Dr. Rolf Gonzalez, a University of California, San Francisco associate dean, said during a recent campus town hall. Gonzalez said that he has noticed an additional lag in how long it takes a rapid test to turn positive following the onset of symptoms, especially early on. Some people aren't testing positive using rapid tests until 4 or 5 days after they start to show symptoms, according to UC San Francisco infection diseases expert Dr. Peter Chen Hong. That's very common these days, he says. At home, COVID-19 rapid tests are expected to detect a coronavirus infection at least 80% of the time, according to the FDA. By contrast, a lab-based PCR test is generally expected to detect the virus 90% of the time someone is infected. But PCR tests can take a day or longer to process, while rapid test results are available within 15 minutes. If you have COVID-19 symptoms and get a negative rapid test result, the FDA suggests testing again 48 hours later. If the second test is negative and you're still concerned your symptoms are caused by COVID-19, the FDA suggests either a third rapid test or a lab-based PCR test. There are a couple of reasons why it's taking longer from the onset of symptoms for some people to test positive using a rapid kit. The Omicron variant family is generally more likely to begin infection in the throat, Chin Hong goes on to say. It takes a while to go up to the nose. So, if you're just swabbing your nose during a test and you have a sore throat, it may mean that you're not getting the virus just there yet, he says. Another possible reason is that the immune systems of people who have been vaccinated and boosted are more likely to recognize an exposure to the coronavirus quickly, triggering symptoms early as a way to fight off the disease, but before there are levels of virus in the body high enough for a rapid test to detect. Before widespread vaccinations, the immune system took a relatively long time before recognizing the coronavirus and triggering an immune response. But in a vaccinated boosted person, they already have immune cells floating around to recognize the enemy. And when you get infected, the immune system activates much faster, Chin Hong said. Now the immune system is saying, hey, something is up, and you start to feel ill. But actually, there's not as much virus around. Whatever the reason, any potential delay in confirming coronavirus infection is all the more reason for residents to abide by one of the most often cited public health mantras over the past 2.5 years. Stay home if you feel sick. If you have symptoms of respiratory illness, if you have symptoms that you think may indicate that you might have COVID-19, please, please, please stay home, says LA County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer. Now let's go to Washington. Cheney's defeat, end of an era for GOP. It's Trump's party now. In Washington, Liz Cheney's resounding primary defeat marks the end of an era for the Republican Party as well as her own family legacy, the most high-profile political casualty yet as the party of Lincoln transforms into the party of Trump. The fall of the three-term congresswoman who has declared it her mission to ensure Trump never returns to the Oval Office was vividly foreshadowed earlier this year on the first anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol. As the House convened for a moment of silence, Cheney, who is leading the investigation into the insurrection as vice chair of the 1/6 committee, and her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney, stood almost alone on the Republican side of the House floor. Democratic lawmakers streamed by to shake their hands. Republicans declined to join them. Liz Cheney represents the Republican Party as it used to be. All of that is gone now, said Geoff Gabaservice, VP of Political Studies at the center-right Niskanen Center. What comes next for Liz Cheney is still to be determined. Now the real work begins, she said in an election night concession speech in Wyoming, summoning the legacy of both Abraham Lincoln and his Civil War era military and presidential successor, Ulysses S. Grant, in her campaign against Trump. Cheney could very well announce her own run for the White House, unlikely to win a hostile Republican Party's nomination, but to at least give those opposed to Trump an alternative. Overnight, she transferred leftover campaign funds into a new entity, the Great Task. That's a phrase from the Gettysburg Address. I will be doing whatever it takes to keep Donald Trump out of the Oval Office, Cheney told NBC's Today Show earlier on Wednesday. Pressed, she said that running for president is something I'm thinking about, and I'll make a decision in the coming months. Whether she runs or not, her belief that Trump poses a danger to democracy is a conviction that runs deep in her family. But it's a view that has no home in today's GOP. Trump is purging the Republican Party, riddling it of dissenters like Cheney and others who dare defy him, shifting the GOP landscape and the makeup of Congress. Of the 10 House Republicans, including Cheney, who voted to impeach Trump for inciting the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the Capitol, only two remain candidates for re-election. The others have bowed out or, like Cheney, have been defeated by Trump-backed challengers. If Republicans gain control of the House and Senate in the November elections, the new Congress is destined to be remade in Trump's image. However, his influence may in fact cut two ways, winning back the House for Republicans, but costing the party the Senate if his candidates fail to generate the broader appeal needed for statewide elections. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, gives a concession speech in this picture to supporters during a primary night event Tuesday in Jackson, Wyoming. Cheney was defeated in a primary race by Wyoming Republican Harriet Hageman. In other news in Washington, U.S. traffic deaths jumped in early 2022, hitting 20-year high. In Washington, more than 9,500 people were killed in traffic crashes in the first 3 months of this year, federal transportation officials said on Wednesday, a figure that represents the deadliest start to a year on the U.S. roads in two decades. In seven states and the District of Columbia, officials estimated crash deaths jumped at least 50%. Nationwide, deaths were up 7% compared with the same period last year. The figures are preliminary estimates, and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration did not release breakdowns of the cause of crashes. Officials say a surge in traffic fatalities that started in 2020 as the pandemic began has continued unabated. The overall numbers are still moving in the wrong direction, said Stephen Cliff, the head of NHTSA. Now is the time for all states to double down on traffic safety. Experts have struggled to come up with an explanation for the spike in deaths, but have pointed to less congestion amid changed driving patterns during the pandemic, which they say have allowed more dangerous speeds. Officials say that there's also evidence of an uptick in reckless behavior, such as driving impaired or without wearing a seatbelt. When everyday life came to a halt in March 2020, risky behaviors skyrocketed and traffic fatalities spiked, Cliff said. We had hoped that these trends were limited to 2020, but sadly they are not. NHTSA reported 7,893 traffic deaths in the first 3 months of 2020, a period mostly before the onset of the pandemic. In 2021, the figure jumped to 8,935 deaths, then rose to 9,560 this year. The number of deaths this year was the highest in the first 3 months of a year since 2002. The first quarter is consistently the least deadly on the U.S. roads. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg earlier this year said that the nation would work to eliminate crash deaths, pledging to adopt a safety system approach that would look as much at the design of roads and cars as the behavior of individual drivers. The effort is backed by billions in new safety funding from last year's infrastructure law, including a $5 billion fund that will provide grants aimed at protecting bicyclists and pedestrians. The Governor's Highway Safety Association, which represents state traffic safety agencies, said that the numbers released Wednesday underscore the need to implement the new strategy. Another new report of an increase in lives lost may feel a bit like Groundhog Day, but we must not become desensitized to the tragedy of roadway deaths, said Jonathan Adkins, the group's executive director. The infrastructure law included mandates for technology that could address some of the biggest cause of fatalities, such as calling for NHTSA to require breath monitoring devices for alcohol in new cars. Such a system is in testing, but is likely still years away. And now let's go to New York. Sources say that the Trump Organization's CFO will testify against the company. In New York, the Trump Organization's longtime chief financial officer will admit to conspiring with the Trump Organization and Trump Payroll Corporation in a 15-year tax fraud scheme. While ahead of the company's finances at a Manhattan Supreme Court hearing today, the New York Daily News said today, Alan Weisselberg is expected to criminally implicate Trump's family real estate business when he pleads guilty to criminal tax fraud charges, a source familiar with the matter told the Daily News on Wednesday. As part of Weisselberg's plea deal, for which he is expected to serve 5 months on Rikers Island, Weisselberg will agree to testify against the companies when they go on trial in October if he is called as a witness, according to a source who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Former President Donald Trump has not been named as a defendant in the Manhattan District Attorney's case, which stems from a broader probe into his business practices. And Weisselberg's plea agreement contains no provision relating to cooperating against Trump, the source said. Weisselberg, age 75, who once referred to himself as Donald Trump's eyes and ears, refused to flip on his ex-boss for almost a year as the Manhattan DA investigated Trump's business practices. Prosecutors indicted the CFO on felony tax fraud charges on June 2021, after it became clear he would not cooperate. And now, going up to Manchester, New Hampshire, Pence tells the GOP to stop lashing out at FBI over Trump search. In Manchester, New Hampshire, former VP Mike Pence on Wednesday implored fellow Republicans to stop lashing out at the FBI over the search of Donald Trump's Florida home and denounced calls by some of the former president's allies to defund the FBI, saying that was just as wrong as a push by Democratic activists to shift money from police. Pence also said he would give due consideration if asked to testify before the House committee investigating the riot at the U.S. Capitol on the 6th of January in 2021. His pleas for restraint come as law enforcement officials warn of an escalating number of violent threats targeting federal agents and government facilities since agents last week searched Mar-a-Lago as part of the Justice Department's investigation into the discovery of classified White House records recovered from Trump's estate earlier this year. Speaking in New Hampshire, Pence said that he's been troubled by what he called the politicalization of the FBI. He also said that the Justice Department and Attorney General Merrick Garland should be more forthcoming about what led authorities to conduct the search. Pence is trying to stake out his own political path, as he and Trump both consider 2024 presidential campaigns. Before Wednesday, Pence had refused to say whether he would engage with the House committee investigating the insurrection if the panel requested his testimony. And now on to Atlanta, Georgia. Giuliani faces grand jury in Georgia 2020 election probe. Rudy Giuliani faced hours of questioning Wednesday before a special grand jury in Atlanta as a target of an investigation into attempts by former President Donald Trump and others to overturn his 2020 election defeat in Georgia. The former New York mayor and Trump attorney left the Fulton County Courthouse without commenting to reporters roughly 6 hours after the special grand jury convened Wednesday as part of the rapidly escalating investigation that has ensnared several Trump allies. Giuliani's questioning took place behind closed doors, as grand jury proceedings are secret. Swarmed by news cameras Wednesday morning as he stepped out of a black SUV at the courthouse steps, Giuliani said that he didn't plan to talk about his testimony. "Grand juries, as I recall, are secret," said Giuliani, who came to court with his attorney, Robert Costello. "They ask the questions, and we'll see." Though grand jury secrecy rules prohibit people present during grand jury testimony from discussing it, that prohibition does not apply to witnesses, including Giuliani. It's unclear how much the former New York mayor and attorney for Trump was willing to say after his lawyers were informed on Monday that he's a target of the investigation. The investigation by Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis has brought heightened scrutiny to the desperate and ultimately failed efforts to overturn Democratic Joe Biden's 2020 election win. It's one of several investigations into Trump's actions in office as he lays the groundwork for another run at the White House in 2024. Willis opened her investigation after the disclosure of a remarkable January 2nd, 2021 phone call between Trump and Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. On that call, Trump suggested that Raffensperger could find the exact number of votes that would be needed to flip the election results in Georgia. And in other news, Kids for Cash judges ordered to pay more than $200 million. Two former Pennsylvania judges who orchestrated a scheme to send children to for-profit jails in exchange for kickbacks were ordered to pay more than $200 million to hundreds of people they victimized in one of the worst judicial scandals in U.S. history. U.S. District Judge Christopher Connor awarded $106 million in compensatory damages and $100 million in punitive damages to nearly 300 people in a long-running civil suit against the judges, writing the plaintiffs are the tragic human casualties of a scandal of epic proportions. In what came to be known as the Kids for Cash scandal, Mark Civarella and another judge, Michael Conahan, shut down a county-run juvenile detention center and accepted $2.8 million in legal payments from the builder and co-owner of two for-profit lockups. Caivarella, who presided over juvenile court, pushed a zero-tolerance policy that guaranteed large numbers of kids would be sent to PA Child Care and its sister facility, Western PA Child Care. Between 2003 and 2008, he ordered children as young as 8 years of age to detention, many of them first-time offenders deemed delinquent for petty theft, jaywalking, truancy, smoking on school grounds, and other minor infractions. The judge often ordered youths he had found delinquent to be immediately shackled, handcuffed, and taken away without giving them a chance to put up a defense or even say goodbye to their families. Caivarella and Conahan abandoned their oath and breached the public trust, Connor wrote in his Tuesday ruling. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court threw out some 4,000 juvenile convictions involving more than 2,300 kids after the scheme was uncovered. Caivarella, age 72, is serving a 28-year prison sentence in Kentucky. Conahan, age 70, was sentenced to 17 years in prison but released to home confinement in 2020. And that does it for the reading of the Gazette for August 18th, 2022, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service, also better known as IRIS. I am your reader, Peter Welch. Thank you so much for listening.